Amanda, we did a wonderful piece today, Wasser, Wien, and the translation would be?
It's not easy to translate, because if you say waters of Vienna or water in Vienna, it doesn't have a sort of poetic quality to it, or it sounds a bit strange. So I think I'd have to think for some time how to say this. German is a far more eloquent language in this regard.
We visited a few places in Vienna related to water, either by name or in reality. And there you can also see the difference between the names and the reality or the real things. And I think this is also true for your conception also of language, because you started off as a traditional poet, but there was also always this reflection of language within your poetical work from the very beginning.
Very much so. And although I think when I started writing poetry as a child, and so I was much more influenced by literary history, I suppose. And then in my teens, I became very interested in visual art. I had a fantastic art teacher when I was in fourth form at high school who taught 20th century art. And that introduced me to a whole range of different conceptual approaches to making art, but also making language. And then when I went to university, we did a lot of discourse analysis. And so this gave me a very different relationship to the palpability of language. And there is actually an analogy between, I guess, how sometimes I feel about language and what we were sometimes doing in our adventure of travelling around Vienna, is the way that language is a reflexive symbolic structure. So, for example, when we were going to the Viennese beaches, to me, coming from Australia and seeing these beaches, it's not a beach, I mean, but at the same time it is a beach, because this symbolic structure of the beach is made a sort of simulacra along the Donau. And so, yes, it does summon up all the richness of the beach through its linguistic associations. But in terms of its materiality, it is so far removed from the beach, as I understand it as an Australian, that as a sort of empirical analysis, nay, it's not the beach. But, of course, language is a rich symbolic structure that speaks us as we speak it. And this is the beauty of language, the richness, the tastiness of language.
Yeah, and with the beach, you always said that a real beach has kind of an endless horizon. And here it's a city as a horizon.
Yes.
With the city beaches.
Yes, and when we went to the Gaza beach, I was thinking about that, and it made me very sad, which I guess is why my reflection when we recorded our spontaneous reactions to what we'd seen was somewhat sad, because to me the beach is analogous to the stars. It's a litmus between humanity and disappearance. And when I go to the beach in Australia, there's this fantastic feeling of shared humanity, that we all become irrelevant. And beautifully, it's a way of dealing with your own mortality and an equalizer, so that many different cultures can come to the beach. And it's like worshipping at the edge of our own disappearance, which brings a great sense of humility and warmth and actually security in dealing with your own mortality. And when I saw the Donau become this split between this empty beach of the
Tel Aviv beach.
The Tel Aviv beach was empty. The security had to be high, and I found that very sad. And then I also found, you know, it's fascinating that the other side was full of people and full of noise. And, of course, I feel very sad for the other side as well. And so this was a real displacement and interesting and saddening metaphor of this beach.
Dealing with these different spots where water is important for Vienna, it's notes you took, but it's also a way of reacting with your voice, with your body, to this reality or to these realities.
And then how can I distill these into symbolic structures of language and vocalizations. And I found this an absolutely fascinating process. Normally, when I'm writing my poetry, I'm almost obsessional. I can often do 40 drafts. And the other extreme, I often improvise with musicians, which is the opposite thing. But in this case, it was a mixture of the two. And it was absolutely fascinating to go to these places. And I was looking and making notes of what I sensed in a very multi-sensual way, from noticing advertising slogans to noticing the narrative that was unfolding at these places, to the smells, to the feeling. Also, the places we went to were so interesting. We went down into the sewers. We went to places where there were traces of water, but no water there. The history of the city, the water beneath, the water beneath the subways. So you got this sense of this complex, labyrinthine, multi-layered Vienna. And, you know, I think you should set up a tour company, because I think this is the best tour I've been on. And also this fascinating thing by where the process of you recording sounds, me making notes, which were trying to just notate some of the sensual and linguistic ideas I was getting, but then coming into the studio was another whole re-realization of how I had reacted to this adventure of going and listening and feeling different water sites within Vienna.
Yeah, and this working in layers, I mean, this is also true, goes for your own literature, voice, sound poetry, that you work like that. And it's also true for your research work. I mean, you told me about this documentary you did on the language of the atom and the atomic bomb and the atomic war and the atomic industry, and it was called The Eclipse of the Man-Made Sun, and they did a lot of research work to establish kind of art piece also.
Yes, I mean, I find that my work manifests very differently depending on what I'm doing, so I still do write sort of some conventional lyric poetry, and then I write a whole lot of poetry that uses different forms, and then I do the oral poetry. And in this film, this was a very long project that was researched part-time over 7 years, and we really did it very fastidiously and very specifically, looking at particular periods and looking at what the political and economic circumstances were and how they related to language use. And in a sense, what we found, which is similar to what you're saying about the multi-layered aspect, is that the emergence of nuclear technology was very interesting in terms of understanding how humans assimilate new technologies and new developments into their language structures. So we weren't so interested in, say, naive ideas of propaganda and the atomic cafe thing. We were more interested in the unconscious motivations that occur. And this was a fascinating example, because the nuclear bomb was unprecedented in human history. And what you found was that the initial descriptions of it that came from scientists used religious language because they were so shocked by it. But it also implied that this thing was so shocking that it was outside of human control. Then you got more domestic analogies as nuclear power started to become a possibility. And I'm simplifying very much here, because it also had to do with political developments that were happening in 1946 and onwards in the United States, and the fight between Britain and America over the control of nuclear development after the Second World War. But I'm now getting too complicated, so I'll try and summarise that over the period of 45 years that we looked at the language in English-speaking countries, you got this development of metaphoric structures. Then you also got the development of a highly specialised language around nuclear weaponry, games theory, systems analysis within the military structures. So new terms and vocabulary were invented, acronyms, modes of grammar associated with that. And in the end, what you did get was this rich, multi-layered structure where it's not as if it is just chronological. Over the period of 45 years, you find that there are many different metaphors. They accumulate over time, and they all become part of that linguistic substructure. So it showed, in a way, the richness of how our language structures are, and showed a very interesting example of how human beings assimilate a new technology into their language structures. Is that enough?
Yeah, it is.
Otherwise I'd talk for 3 hours.
And you, as an Australian, you are, of course, very close to those beautiful Pacific islands where they had those nuclear tests for the weapons.
And we also had nuclear tests in Australia.
In the desert?
Yes, in the desert. And they were of course, named things like wombat, and they were often given Aboriginal names or named after Australian animals. It's a very painful for us to remember what happened there. People in Australia were exposed to radiation. In some areas, Aboriginal people were exposed because the areas weren't vacated adequately. In the Marshall Islands, there were explosions. The French continued nuclear explosions in Tahiti long, long after the British stopped and the Americans. And, yes, it's a very personally distressing history.
Yeah, and for me, when I think of Australia, and especially when I think of Sydney, where you come from and where you are living, when I think of Sydney, I think of water because I think of this wonderful coastline with a lot of water. Wherever you look, it's water, it's bridges, it's islands. And that was the idea. If you, coming from there, going to a place like Vienna, where you just have a river, and this river is more than one river, it's like originally five rivers and now it's like two or three rivers, it must be something very strange to you and very poor to you maybe at the first impression.
No, I found this really special because we just went to places of water. I was able to get a sense in an intimate way for the, perhaps not a Viennese relation to water, but at least an understanding of the complexity of water within Vienna. And I guess I do love water. I'm an obsessive body surfer, as was my mother and my grandmother before me. And it has a very strong resonance. I've been in the sea since I was 6 months old, playing with starfish and mollusks. So to come to another city that has such a intimate integration architecturally and poetically with water was absolutely fabulous. I learned so much, but largely unconscious, not didactic. I'm still trying to make sense of this. It's been a really special experience.
And now something very different, talking about cooperation with other artists. You worked a lot with composers. You were mentioning them before, but also with dancers, with other writers, and with visual artists. So this is also very important for you to kind of extend your artistic possibilities.
Very much so. I mean, when I went to university, a very progressive course which looked at media as well as subjects to do with philosophy and psychoanalysis. So we were working with film and radio and setting up public radio in Australia. It was a very exciting time. I was a poet still, very much just writing in the page at that time. But since that time, I started to collaborate with other radio makers, with composers, dancers, visual artists, new media artists. And it's just been fantastic because I believe that poetry is essentially freedom of thought. It's all very well to have freedom of speech, but if there's no actual freedom of thought going on, then who wants to hear the words? And I found that, when I used to work at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation in Sydney, whenever I made my documentaries or features, to me it was important to try and make a form and a formalist statement that created an active form of listening. And to me, poesis was inherent as a structural possibility in any medium. And this was a wonderful inspiration. And I've found that because we have this problem in Australia and I think elsewhere, that poetry is reaching a very limited audience. Because it is not commercially viable, the distribution and production of poetry is hampered. And also I was disturbed to see some of the Philistine developments occurring in areas of the media, and I wanted to inject poesis into that. And I believe poesis is a fluid conceptual idea now, even though I still love writing my straight poetry, so-called, and I can be an obsessive then, and I love it, and that's really my main thing. But to be able to open up and try and apply poetic principles to these other media, I find liberating. And I also think it's terribly important for the future, because young people these days, their habits are changing. The language structures are changing through the use of mobile phones, texting, etc. And unless we can bring poesis into our lives in an assertive way, we're really in danger of a Philistine didactic future.
But talking about media, I mean, just for Australia, since it's such a big country, continent, you need the media, you need the contemporary, the new media. You have those mobile phones, you have internet and all that stuff are very important for people to meet, so to speak,
yes,
because the distances are so big. Your ways of connecting with people are also a way really depend on the new media.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And in fact, like, the scene in Australia, or certainly in Sydney and Melbourne, with new media stuff has always been very progressive and good, and still is. And in fact, I think it's probably one of the strongest art forms in terms of Australia's international circulation that there is. And you're right, those media are really crucial. I think to have the flexibility of being able to apply poetic principles to these different media, it's fun, first and foremost, and it just gives you endless lateral possibilities conceptually, rather than having to think in these more limited ways.
So your work you can find in books, but you can find it mainly on CDs. Can you find them in the internet?
Yes, there's quite a lot of my work on the internet. Quite a lot of my written texts are on the internet, so if you Google me, you'll see a number of things come up. There's a very nice feminist literary site called How To that comes out of the United States. There's some gorgeous young people in Sydney who've set up a poetry website called When Pressed. So there's quite a lot of my textual material on the net. And also I do these visual works that pertain to language. Some of those are also on the net. And then there's a nice live performance, or an embarrassing one, but, you know, I guess it's okay. A video from the Proposta Festival in Barcelona. If you just Google me, you'll see some of the dance stuff, some of the printed works, that's what's so great about the net, isn't it? That you do have these lateral possibilities of representation.
What's also interesting, that it always goes with meeting people in person. You know, when you are at festivals, because you mentioned Barcelona, you now came from Linz, where you had a performance with a German composer and musician. And so you come to Vienna. So it's also important at the same time, even so you are connected with the new media, to meet people personally, to get on with this kind of network.
Very much so. I mean, you know, the net in a way is a substitute for the richness of one-to-one. I come to Europe a lot, you know, I used to come two or three times a year and probably spend almost half my life over here. Partly that was because I have so many fantastic colleagues in other countries that I want to work with and do things with. But particularly, like, the best thing is just going out, having a few drinks, having dinner. We can get into incredible, like, discussions where I've come away afterwards and had written a new poem, or had a whole level of ideas that weren't there before, because the internet's great, but it's, you know, the phone's better, but one-to-one with a glass of red wine, mwah.